What is God's provision? The fifth talk in a series titled Biblical Christianity 101 was presented by Ron Julian on October 24, 2000, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching.
If I were to say to you, I have this great news. This team of people is going to come over to your house and tear up your floors and take apart all the pipes under your flooring. You probably would say, well, gosh, that doesn't sound like such great news. I mean, I don't need that problem. Well, if you have this terrible problem with your plumbing and it has overflowed and your floors have been ruined and none of the plumbing in your house is working, then to say somebody's going to come over to your house and rip up the floors and take all your pipes apart could be really good news, because you've got a problem and it needs that kind of a solution. Well, in the same way, the good news that the Bible proclaims, we're not really going to understand it as good news. We're really not going to see it as the gospel, the good news that it's claimed to be, unless we can see that it actually is addressing the very real problems that we have. And David made a case last week for the nature of those problems, and so today I want to suggest that what God has done is to make a provision for the actual desperate situation of human beings. The news is bad concerning the human condition, and that's not a thing to say lightly. The fact is it is bad, but that's why God's solution is such good news, because it really does meet the problem. The bad news, in fact, I think we could, in order to talk about God's provision, we could kind of divide the bad news up into two parts, because there are two aspects to the provision that God makes. There's the bad news and the even worse news. It seems to me that the bad news is that I have terrible problems as a human being that only God can solve. I'm going to die and I can't do anything about it. I am evil and I am suffering because of my evil, and other people are suffering because of my evil, and I am suffering because of other people's evil. Life is frustrating. I try to make something of it, and it seems as if something starts to come together, but ultimately it kind of eludes my grasp. I can't quite make it work. Only God can solve these problems. They're big problems, and I can't solve them. Unfortunately, the even worse news is that God is not happy with me. The one who can solve my problem is alienated from me because of my sin. He's good, I'm not. Well, what's the solution then to the problem? We can state the solution very simply. I mean, any kid who's been in Sunday school can tell you what the solution is. Jesus is the answer. The problem is, what does that mean? Do we know what we're saying when we say that Jesus is the answer? If Jesus is the answer, then what is the question? I think many of us, many in the church, are confused about Jesus. We know that he's supposed to be a big deal, but we don't actually exactly know why. I mean, I think many people that I've talked to, if you were to ask them, why is Jesus a big deal? The answer that they would give is, well, he's a big deal because he's God. Well, that's true. He is. But actually, that answer doesn't take us very far. As astounding as it is to say that Jesus is God incarnate, the fact is, that's a very abstract sort of notion that actually doesn't take you very far. I mean, if I start out believing that there is a God, and you come along and tell me, by the way, Jesus is God incarnate, okay, now I've got another piece of information, but I'm still kind of stuck where I was before. What does that mean? What's the significance of that to me? I had a God who was in the sky, and now I have a God who's in a man, and where does that leave me? What is this about? What I want to argue tonight is that Jesus is the solution that God has provided to the tragedy of human existence. That is why he is a big deal. The Bible makes a big deal of him because he is the provision that God has made for the desperate problems that we have as human beings. So I want to talk about that tonight, just in general terms. So if Jesus is going to be the provision that is going to solve the problem of human beings, the first problem we have to deal with is this problem that God is not happy with us. Mankind has always tried to figure out, how am I going to get God or the gods or the powers that be or however I picture what it is I have to deal with out there, how am I going to get them on my side? And so we make up rituals and chants and prayers and burn things and sacrifice things and do all sorts of things to try to get the powers that be out there on our side. I recognize that I can't do this by myself, and I'm trying to get the one out there who can to be on my side so that the rains will come and the crops will grow and whatever it is I need is going to come my way. This has been a great preoccupation of humanity from the beginning. How can I get the powers that be out there on my side? Now, there's an awful lot of superstition involved in that and a misunderstanding of who God is and what life is all about, but there is a grain of truth in that perception. The fact is that I do need to have God on my side. It makes all the difference in the world whether God is for me or against me. That's a fundamental truth that we find in the Bible. It makes all the difference in the world. Is God on my side or isn't he? The problem is that the God that I am dealing with is totally, completely, and absolutely good and holy, morally pure, righteous, just, all of those kinds of ideas. And the very essence of things, the way things are and the way things are supposed to be, has everything to do with these ideas. With the concept of what is good, what is loving, what is right, what is just. And the problem, as David talked about last week, is everything that is so central to what life ought to be about is very far from what we are as people. I've got this problem. The God that I need to have on my side is good, and I'm not. God is good. We are evil, and that puts us in a desperate situation. Now, if we don't believe that or understand that, then nothing that I'm going to say in the rest of this is going to make any sense or be compelling to you, because the entire biblical message has to do with, is built on the foundation of that problem. The fact is that there is an actual God who created me, a God who is good, before whom I am guilty, and before whom one day I am going to stand and give an account of my life. That's one of the basic ideas that you find in the Bible. It's very interesting. When Paul went to preach in Athens to a very sophisticated audience of Greeks, part of the basic message that he proclaimed was, there is a day coming when God is going to judge the world. That's a fundamental part of the message, the proclamation that he had. You have not dealt with reality if you haven't come to terms with the fact that there is a judgment coming. There is a day when you're going to stand before your Creator and you're going to give an account for the life that you lived. And the judge that we are going to stand before is totally just. What a predicament. I'm going to stand before my Creator as my judge, and He's going to look at me and He's going to see right down to the very bottom every little ounce of selfishness and greed and lack of love and lack of love for God and every bit of it. What am I going to do? What are the alternatives? How could it come out? Well, if God is just, if God believes in justice and rightness and goodness, He's going to look at me and He's going to say, that's not it. That is not the way it's supposed to look. And He's going to take my life and render a guilty verdict on it, one which I will deserve, and I will stand condemned. That's one way it could turn out. How am I going to escape this? Well, another way it could turn out, another possibility would be God could just say, ah, heck, it's okay. You're evil. You've rebelled against me. You have hurt other people. You're selfish. The very fiber of reality is built to resonate and revolve around goodness. And that goodness is not what you have lived, but no big deal. Why don't you just come on in anyway? Well, it sounds good at first. Hey, great, a free pass. I just get to get in anyway. But what about justice? What about what is right and good? Is God just going to say to all of the people who have suffered at the hands of evil men and women in this world, well, I just decided to let them off. It's okay. No big deal. So they're evil. I don't care. That's not really what we want. The fact is, as much as I recognize that I need mercy if I'm going to survive, there's also something in us, I think, that is a part of the way we have been built by God that responds to the idea of justice. Something needs to be done. We can't just sweep it under the rug and pretend that it didn't happen. There seems to need to be some response to this. Well, that's why the solution that God provides in Jesus is so awe-inspiringly brilliant, really, when you think about it. God becomes a man and offers Himself as an offering for our sin. He's not just overlooking sin. Jesus takes the sins of the world upon Himself and pays with His own life. In the cross of Christ, the death of Christ on the cross, we see both the justice of God and the mercy of God. We see justice because there we see what God thinks about sin. Here is a man paying the price with his life. And yet at the same time, it is about mercy, because God isn't asking me to pay the price. He took it upon Himself. So He didn't just wave His hand and say, it's okay. He said, it's not okay. Something needs to be done. And the thing that needed to be done, He did Himself. He took it upon Himself so that I didn't have to. Ultimately, that's what the cross is all about. It is this way that God can be, as Paul says in Romans, that God can be both just and the justifier of the one who has faith in Jesus. And the picture there is, on the one hand, God is righteous. He is just. He is not one who overlooks evil. He is righteous. And yet at the same time, He is justifying us. He is putting us in the right with Himself through Jesus. And when we talk about the cross, I should make it clear that it's not just His death that we're talking about, but we're talking about the resurrection as well. Because it would be one thing to claim that man's death was an offering to God that was acceptable for the sins of the world. But one of the things that the resurrection shows us, the fact that Jesus rose from the dead, it shows us many things, but one of the things that it shows us is that the offering of his life was accepted by God. This is the power of God coming along and raising him up from the dead, saying, yes, he's the one. The death that he died, I accept it. That is an offering that is acceptable to me. The cross of Christ then gives us a place to stand. It gives us a place to begin. I don't have to pretend that I am not guilty. I am guilty. I can admit that I am guilty. I can know that I am guilty. But my guilt has been dealt with. I am forgiven. I have been shown mercy. I am under God's grace. These are all various phrases that the Bible uses to describe the same reality. I have been accepted by God. I have God on my side. My guilt is no barrier. That's what I need, is to have God on my side. And that's one of the things that Paul argues so profoundly in his letters, is that that's what Jesus did for us, is to make it possible for God to be on our side in spite of the fact that we have transgressed against what is right and good. Paul points to the cross of Christ, what God did in accepting the death of Jesus on the cross. And then he says things like, if God is for us, who can be against us? Look at what he did to reconcile us to him. If he's on my side, then he's the only guy I need on my side. The fact is, I mean, not that I'm inviting this, but you all could be against me. You could all gang up together and be against me. And the fact is that I have got the one on my side that I need. You cannot prevail against him. Now, I don't want to give you any ideas. But the fact is that I have got the one on my side without whom I am lost and with whom I cannot be lost, no matter who else is against me. Now, perhaps you've heard the expression, sometimes people describe Jesus as prophet, priest, and king. What we're talking about here is the second of those descriptions, Jesus as a priest. Hebrews makes this picture, a very profound and beautiful picture, of Jesus as a priest who has made an offering to God on our behalf. The offering is himself. It's as if you picture the priest coming to the altar and laying the offering on the altar or something like that. Only the offering that he has made is the offering of his own life. But as our priest, he made the one offering that counts, the one offering that actually works. It's the only one that's needed. And so the picture is, I have been reconciled to God. He has mediated. Here I am under the wrath of God, and Jesus has come between us, offering himself and made peace between us. That's the picture. Okay, so the first part of the provision that God has made for our problem is he has dealt with the problem of our guilt. And it may not seem like a big deal. You know, it's like somebody coming along and offering to solve a problem for you that you had not really been aware that you had. It sort of takes you by surprise. Oh, that's great. Thanks for solving this problem that I didn't know I have. So now, when you solve the problem, I will be in the same situation I was before I knew it. I thought I didn't have this problem, and now you're going to come along and solve it for me, so now I'm in the position that I don't have this problem, which is where I thought I was before. It can seem sort of trivial, but the fact is it is not trivial because the problem is a profound one. If I do not have God on my side, I am lost. And Jesus has made it possible for God to be just and yet to be merciful at the same time. And that's a profound thing. Okay. Then we move to the second part of the provision then. Now that I am in God's favor, I can reap the benefit. If He is on my side, then being on my side, He is going to go to work and solve the rest of those problems that I have as a human being. This is one of the central things. I mean, if you take anything away from the Bible at all, I think you really need to take this away. And in my experience, it very often gets missed. The whole idea of the mercy that Jesus brought us through what He did on the cross is in order to make it possible for God to go on then and bless us, to go on and solve the problem of our life. It's not just, you were guilty. I was? Yes, you were, but now you're not. So, go ahead now. You're not guilty anymore. Great. And then we just cruise on and live as if nothing has changed. It's not like that. The mercy that God has that Jesus has brought our way is for a purpose. God is being merciful in order then that He can come along and in His mercy solve the problem that we cannot solve. He's already solved part of the problem, the big stumbling block. He has solved the problem of our guilt. And right now, as a believer, my understanding of what the Bible is telling me is that I stand under the grace of God right now, in spite of the fact that I still today, as regretfully as I have to say this, the fact is that I still fall very far short of what I ought to be as a human being. It's not that God has come along and said, okay, I forgive you for all that stuff you did back then, but now from now on you'd better clean your act up or you're going to be in trouble. The fact is my act is still dirty. I still wrestle with my own selfishness and greed and a preoccupation with myself over other people and a preoccupation with myself over God. I'm called to love God and love my neighbor, and so often I find it so easy to just love me instead. Just let's forget God, forget you. I'm actually more interested in me. That's something that I have fought from the day that I first became a believer until now. So, on what basis then do I feel secure? Do I feel confident in my relationship with God? My confidence is based on the fact that my relationship with God doesn't depend on my lack of guilt. I know I'm guilty of sin in many ways. I can look at that. I can see it as a reality. My relationship with God depends on the mercy that He determined to bring me and that He bought for me through what Jesus did on the cross. So, today, I stand under the grace of God, and I am in that grace so that God, being merciful, can go to work on me and move my life from the lost place where He finds it to ultimately being rescued, redeemed, saved, the problems of my life completely solved. And that may seem strange to say, because if you look around, I think all of us, I don't know of any Christian who would ever say that all their problems are solved. So what do I mean? God is showing us mercy so that He can solve all our problems? Well, yes. Ultimately, that's exactly right. God has shown us mercy in Christ so that He can solve all our problems. Part of where we get hung up is we haven't recognized that God has a different perspective on what those problems are and what the solution is than we do. But the fact is, the message, the very clear and profound message of the Bible is that Jesus died in order that we might have life, in order that we might be rescued from death and sin and futility and all of that. Okay. We kind of have to divide this then into two parts. If we're talking about what Jesus has brought our way because we are under the mercy of God, first of all, where does that leave me today? Here I stand. Paul describes us as standing in the grace of God. It's as if I've walked into the entryway. There's this big palace, and I have walked in the door, and now I'm in. I am here under the mercy of God. Where am I? What does that mean for today? What's going on? What is His mercy, His grace doing for me today? Well, there's a simple answer to that. Paul describes it in a powerful way in Romans 8. He says, all things work together for good for those who love God and who are called according to His purpose. It's a very simple and profound idea. Because God is on my side, He is saying there is not one thing in this world that can get at me ultimately, that can separate me from God's purpose to bless me and to solve the problem of my life. It's not that I am waiting someday for God to be pleased with me. He is pleased with me now. And He is acting for my good now, today, right this minute. As difficult as that may seem, as difficult as that may be to believe at times, as hard as it is to recognize sometimes in the midst of our difficulties that that is happening, that is where we stand. God in His goodness is at work on me now, working for my good. What every pagan tries to accomplish through sacrifices and rituals and incantations and spells and prayers and all of that to somehow get the gods on your side, the child of God, the believer, is in that place already. I have God on my side now. I don't have to convince Him to be on my side. I don't have to pray to Him and urge Him to be on my side. He is on my side and at work for my good. We don't have the time to go into this tonight, but I would suggest that there is a model out there. There is a picture of the Christian life where we are urged to see ourselves as kind of going in and out of God's favor. If I have sinned, or if I haven't confessed my sins, or something like that, that I'm in fellowship, and I'm out of fellowship, and up and down, and up and down, and I need to get myself back in God's good graces somehow. And I would argue that that is a profoundly unbiblical idea. If I am a child of God, I am in God's good graces. He is on my side. That is how it works. Even when He disciplines me, even when I need to be corrected and taught about the error of my ways, still, it is an act of love because He is on my side, totally and irrevocably. What does that get me? You know, is it so God is on my side, that and $1.25 will get me a cup of coffee? I mean, what is there? What is the actual result of that in my life that I'm living now? Well, the picture that the Bible presents, I think, is fundamentally that what God is most interested in, the problem that He is most interested in solving in my life now, is the problem of my foolishness. The problem of the fact that as a human being I am incredibly short-sighted, that I lose track of the big picture. I forget who God is. I forget who I am. I forget what's really important. And that God in His goodness today, in my life today, the issue that is on the front burner is God is determined to teach me. This is the time of my education. This is the time when I have to learn the lessons about what it means to be a human being living under God. We talked about Jesus being prophet, priest, and king. And we talked about His being the priest who has made the offering of Himself to reconcile me to God. He is also the greatest of the prophets. He is the teacher, the one who has come along and explained more clearly than anyone ever has what life is about, what God is all about, where life is to be found, how life is to be lived. My agenda in this life, or I should say God's agenda for me, is that I would be a disciple of Jesus, that I would learn from him, that I would learn what he values, learn what he knew, learn what he wanted me to know. The great thing about it is that Jesus is not just the kind of teacher who comes, gives his lesson, and then kind of hopes that his students are going to get it. The fact is that we also have a profound picture in the Bible painted of the Spirit of God at work, opening our eyes, teaching us what we need to know, softening our hearts so that we are actually able to learn the lessons that God is teaching us through the trials and difficulties of our life. That's actually a major theme in something like Paul's letters. The idea that because I am under the grace of God, because of what Jesus did on the cross, I have the Spirit of God at work. I really like the picture in 2 Corinthians. You may have heard the story about how Moses used to go in before the presence of God, which was this glory, sort of the shining glory that God would put in a certain spot to represent his glory. And Moses would go in before this glory and talk to God. And when he came out, there would be this shine on his face. The glory of God would shine on his face. And he used to put a veil over it because the people were scared. I mean, in essence, it was like having the glory of God. They didn't want to go in and talk to God. God was too scary. And this sort of shine from God on Moses' face, they didn't want to deal with that either. And so Moses would put a veil over his face. Well, Paul pictures our situation as believers is as being this. Because of what Jesus has done now, it's as if I have been brought into the very presence of God. The barrier between us has been broken down. And just like Moses, I'm standing before the glory of God and his glory is coming off on me. Only, we're not talking about a literal shine. He makes it clear that he's talking about the work of the Spirit. And we're talking about me becoming more and more like God. I don't mean that I'm becoming omniscient or I'm becoming the creator of the universe or anything like that, but God's character, God's heart, God's understanding of things. I am so far from that, and yet through the work of the Spirit of God, I am moving closer to having a personality, an understanding, a commitment to things that is like God's. That's a pretty profound thing. In this life, the Spirit of God is at work in me, softening my heart, teaching me, leading me, and the specific truths that I am wrestling with are the truths that Jesus, as the great prophet, has taught me. Now, there are other things that God is doing in his kindness in my life today. I mean, there are all sorts of things that he's providing for my physical well-being and so on. But fundamentally, when it comes down to it, the top priority is that I would learn, that I would come to see things the way they are, that I would come to know God and love God and understand something of his purposes and his character and come to be like him. That's what's on the agenda for today. And that is a part of the provision that God has made for my problem as a human being. His Spirit at work, leading me out of foolishness and darkness and ignorance into some sort of understanding of what's going on. The final part of this then, God's favor not only has an impact on where I'm living today, but most profoundly and probably most importantly, God's favor has something to say about my future. The fact that Jesus has bought my reconciliation with God means that I have a hope. My life is headed someplace. I am on a journey, as I often say. I am on a journey to the place where I most want to be. And what makes it possible for me to arrive at that destination? Again, it is what Jesus did on the cross. I have been accepted, and so I have, and here are the kinds of words the Bible uses. I have an inheritance. It's like I am a member of a family, and I know that one day I am going to inherit this great estate. The Spirit is called the down payment. Again, something has begun now, but it is just like the earnest money. It's just that little thing at the beginning that guarantees that the big inheritance down the line comes along. So much of the biblical message is about concepts like the promises of God, the hope of the believer, the inheritance of the believer, those things that are out there in front of me. Now, we already know part of what that hope is. I stood condemned. One day the judgment of God is going to come down upon this world, and without what Jesus did on the cross, all I have to look forward to is condemnation. So I've been saved from that. So on the one hand, I know when that judgment comes, that judgment is not going to come down on me. On the other hand, though, it is not just the absence of judgment, but there is a positive side to this. There is a blessing that constitutes what God has provided as the solution to my problems. Again, the answer is Jesus, because one way of describing what it is that God has in store for us is He has in store for us a kingdom. You hear people talk a lot about the kingdom of God. Well, what's the big deal? What does that mean? Why do I care about the kingdom of God? Jesus is prophet, priest, and king. Priest who makes the offering that reconciles me to God. The prophet who proclaims the truth that leads me out of error into understanding and wisdom. And he is the king. The one who is going to rule over all of creation. I don't know. I think where we are right now in our own particular history, it may be hard for us for this idea to resonate. I mean, I don't want to put words in anybody's mouth, and maybe some people would not agree with me here, but I know who it is that I'm going to vote for to lead our country here when the election comes up. But I'm not hugely excited about it, I have to say. It's not as if the person that I'm going to vote for, I have huge confidence in. It's rather that I have less confidence in the people that he's running against. That's kind of the way it is. Well, maybe some of you are more enthusiastic than that. I'm not asking you to agree with me there. But I think in general, we have a kind of a... My generation, moving from the kind of the romantic picture of Camelot and all of that with John F. Kennedy, through the Vietnam War and Watergate and all of that sort of stuff, by this time, people my age are pretty cynical about government, about, you know, is anybody actually going to do anything? Are they going to make any difference? Do the people we put there actually have our best interests in mind, or are they just ambitious people who like having on their resume that they were president of the United States? I mean, what is it really? I mean, I'm going to start talking politics. I'll get myself in trouble. So when we say Jesus is going to be king, maybe we don't immediately resonate with that. Like, what's the big deal? Well, the big deal is you have to have this picture of a king as one who has understanding, who executes justice, who deals fairly, who establishes his people in a good life. Jesus as king is a picture of the one who above all understands what human life is all about, who is executing the will of God in creation, who has taken all opposition, every bit of sin and evil and death and futility in the world, everything that stands in opposition to the ultimate will of God is going to be put down and destroyed. Jesus' rule means that he has made the world the way he wants it to be. In a sense, he's a dictator. He's coming along and saying, this is the way it's going to be. The thing about it is, though, the way that he wants it to be is the way it ought to be. So the idea that God is going to rule over all creation through Jesus is a picture of human life restored. What is it that is robbing human life of so much of its fulfillment? Well, sin is robbing human life of its fulfillment. And in the kingdom of God, sin, it will be totally eradicated. Evil. As I look around, there are a number of people here who are significantly younger than I am. So, this gives me no superiority whatsoever, except for the fact that I have been messing up longer than any of you have had the opportunity to do. I mean, some of you know what it's like to mess up for 12 years. Some of you know what it's like to mess up for 18 years. I have been messing up for 47 years. So I've got you beat here. And what that means is that I think maybe, possibly, I have an even better understanding than some of you do of what kind of a thief evil is, what human selfishness does inside, what my evil has done to me. I've seen it. What it has done to other people. I've lived with it for a long time. What other people's evil has done to me. I've seen it for a long time. I'm not trying to pull rank on you here or anything, but what I'm trying to get at is when the Bible tells me that the kingdom of God, the new heavens and the new earth, where righteousness dwells, is what we're told. When the Bible tells me about something like that, I am at a point in my life where that makes huge sense to me. This is the thing about the kingdom of God that appeals to me most of all. That I am going to be the sort of person who from my heart does what is good, wants what is good, loves God, loves my neighbor. I am sick of wrestling with my stupid selfishness. I am sick to death of it, and I am ready to move on. I am ready to be what I ought to be. That's what God is promising. The kingdom of God is the place where we're all going to be like that. No death. Ecclesiastes paints a really powerful picture, the book of Ecclesiastes, of how death in this world robs us. You want to try to make something substantial? You want to try to do something that's really going to matter? There are things that you can do. But ultimately, all of the things that really matter are the things that have the eternal consequences. The things that you can do in the heart and life of someone who is going to live on in the kingdom of God. Because the stuff you can do in this world, it's all going to go. Build up a great fortune. Pass it on to your children. And find out later on that they squander it. They're ungrateful, they don't appreciate it. They didn't want it to begin with. My dad wanted me to take over the family business, but I want to make movies, so I'm, forget it. Keep keep the garage, I'm going to go off to Hollywood, and we try so hard to make something work in this life, but one of the things that keeps robbing us is death. I mean, you can only go so far, and then you're out of the picture. It's very interesting and sad in a way to read things from the past, to get this picture of the lives people lived and how important these things were to them, these things that are gone now. They're just gone. And most people don't even know anything about it. I still remember a sermon that I heard about Ecclesiastes where the preacher said, "You think you're going to live on in your children? So name your great-grandfather." How many of you know the name of your great-grandfather? So we got a little piece of immortality here and there. Not many. The fact is that death ends up, it is the ultimate thief. Death has been conquered. Death has been destroyed. And all of the futility that goes with that. I can't tell you exactly what life in the kingdom of God is going to be like. But what I know is that it is a place where the life that I live is not in vain. That what I do counts for something. My heart is right. My perspective is right. I know God. I love God. I love you. And I am working towards something that is worth doing. I don't know what it is. I don't know what it is going to look like. But I know that what I'm going to do is a life that is going to be worth living. And then, God's provision for the problem of human life is Jesus. Jesus is prophet, priest, and king. He is the priest who has reconciled me to God, who has solved the great problem of my guilt. It is a great problem. I have God on my side, not because I won him to my side, but because Jesus is the high priest who offered himself up for me. Jesus is the great prophet, the one who has made clearer than anyone ever has to humanity what life is about. And the grace of God in this life is working to teach me something of what that is about. To open my eyes, to give me wisdom and perspective. And ultimately, I have this great hope that everything that is the enemy of life now is going to be conquered under the rule of Jesus, the King of God's kingdom forever, where we will find no sin, no death, no futility, but life with a capital L. That's what I understand God's provision to be for the problem of human life. And it seems to me that it's a pretty good one. But I'll leave that to you to decide. So, what I'd like to do now is give you an opportunity to ask any questions or make any comments or whatever you might want to do. Or we could talk about, have you seen any good movies?
I just had a comment. You could use the, it's just sort of a side note. In politics, you could use the biblical method and just listen to a bush.
Yeah, that's right. But I think some of the Democrats might want to make it a burning bush, and that probably wouldn't be good. Like I say, I'm not asking anybody to share my lack of enthusiasm. The only reason I mention that is just, I think for all of us, the idea that who's in charge is going to make some big difference, we might sort of have lost sight of that could actually happen. But the fact is, ultimately, who's in charge makes a big difference. And that's why the kingdom of God is a big deal.
As far as the current tense, because you dealt with God dealing, supplying a solution for a past and a future, current tense, in what specific ways do you understand God's provision for our current dilemma, namely being stuck on itself, is different from that in that was available in the Old Covenant? And in other words, is it more than just teaching us wisdom, directing us towards the right goals, external forces, or is there something added that's also internal as well?
Well, no, it's very much internal. That's what I meant when I was talking about the provision of the Spirit, the work of the Spirit. That's absolutely central. Because no, it's not just that we have been given the best information, but that we have. I mean, we have better information than anybody has ever had before Jesus came along. But we see the language in the Old Testament, Moses talking to Israel about the fact that he's talking to them as they're about to go into the promised land, and he tells them that, you know what, basically what's going to happen? God's offering you a deal here. You follow him and trust him and keep his law, and he'll bless you in the land. And you know what's going to happen? You're not going to do it, and you're going to be carried off into captivity. But there is a day coming when God is going to circumcise your hearts. Later on, the prophet Jeremiah, looking back and basically saying, okay, now here we are. Here are the Babylonians. What is it that God's going to do? He's going to make a new covenant with you, and he's going to write his law on your heart. That's the picture. I mean, it's a very much an internal thing. I mean, the picture is God at work on the inside so that the reality of the blessings that he has promised can come to us. I am the sort of person who can inherit a blessing from God because my heart is being circumcised and his law is being written upon it and that sort of thing. So no, very much an internal thing. But I would want to put the two together because it's not an internal thing. It's not primarily that the Spirit is coming along and directly pouring new information into my brain. It's rather my eyes, my ability to respond to the truth, to acknowledge the truth and bow to it and understand it and learn from it and grow from it and all of that. That's where the Spirit is at work, so that the information that Jesus is giving me, the teaching that I get there, is something that I can take in. I mean, that's what he talked to his disciples about. You know, most of the people I'm talking to here, they don't get it. You know, they just don't. I can talk to them all day long, and they're just not going to get it. But you are getting it, and that's the great reality of our lives as believers now. Sometimes I think we don't recognize how miraculous our lives as believers really are. I mean, the fact that we are actually growing to know a God that before we would have run from, you know, stay away from me. That's a profoundly important thing. But yes, that's good. Very much an internal thing.
Being made not just okay, I'll do this, but from the inside out, being made willing to highly desire to want to do this.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yes, and that's a profound thing. And that's why I put that in today. That's a part of the provision. That's a part of what God has done for our problem. Is as much as we wrestle and struggle with things, the fact is that believers in this world, there is a light on inside. There is something happening there, and that's a light that God Himself has turned on. So that's a profoundly important thing. I think. You know, I describe myself as having 47 years to mess up, and I mean that. But I don't mean to suggest that I have done nothing but mess up in those 47 years, because the fact is, as a believer, I also believe, I mean, I can also see in my life that I have grown. I want things that I didn't used to want, and I know things that I didn't used to know, and I didn't even want to know them. And that's a profoundly important thing. I mean, I wouldn't trade it for anything. I mean, I'm a long ways from where I want to be, ultimately, but I have come a distance, and it means everything to me that I have come that distance. And it's the Spirit of God, I think, that has done that. Bill?
This may have been more of last week's discussion, which I was unable to make, but...
I was unable to make it too, so we can really share our ignorance here.
But you did, you alluded to it, and you were just talking about there, that the problem could seem trivial because God has solved this problem that I didn't know I had. Mm-hmm. And, I could speak first person or third person about that. I know I find it extremely helpful to be reminded of that. Just for the fact that you say it, that we can see that as trivial, and I can say, yes, I can see that as trivial. I sometimes treat that in a trivial manner. Yeah. Also, I've been in conversations with people where I state that, as mm-hmm. something that I know, even though it's not something that I always grasp and hold on to. And I'm more confronted with that, even like the an age of or an age of accountability, that babies can't sin. For example, talking about Romans 3, it says all have sinned, and somebody's saying, well, that can include babies because this is all have sinned, it's the choice to sin, as if to say that Paul, at least, they're saying that in that passage, he's not talking about the state of being a sinner, or being a rebel, whether or not you actually act upon that state. So it's helpful for me to kind of keep talking about that issue and maybe kind of thinking about it afresh, or thinking about ways to either look in the mirror and say that to myself, don't treat this as something trivial, or in conversations with others, to kind of get some new ideas instead of just kind of saying, well, all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Can you help me think about that a little bit more to see that this is a fundamental problem that I'm born with, as opposed to something that I start out with this clean slate and I gradually learn sin because of the fallen world that I'm in? Because that's some of the perspectives that I've encountered.
Right. I don't know if I can. Let me see if I can take a shot at it. We get kind of biblical evidence from various directions, little pieces here and there, trying to put it together. There has been kind of a tendency in some Christian circles to want to turn to emphasize sin as being sin is the explicit breaking of a known commandment. On the radio show, I don't know if your listening goes back this far, but we had a guy who used to call in years ago who, his argument was that he did not sin. Several guys met with him and his wife, and from their perspective, he treated his wife terribly. He was disrespectful and sort of verbally abusive and at one point, this was sort of called to his attention that, he was being very selfish and disrespectful in the way that he was treating her. What did he mean that he didn't sin? And in essence, his answer was, well, that's not sin. That's just, I had a tiring day and, I'm just human nature. I'm just kind of, Sin would be if I didn't keep the Sabbath, because God told me to keep the Sabbath, and if I were to take some Sabbath and work on it, that would be sin, because that's a known commandment, and then I'm breaking it. But for me to be selfish and disrespectful to my wife is just, I'm tired and give me a break. Well, that's kind of an extreme example of how by turning sin into this sort of, okay, it's these outward acts that I commit against some particular commandment that I really insulate myself from the reality of how much sin is an inner disposition, that essential selfishness, that thing that says, I'm more important than God and I'm more important than my neighbors. So it has always seemed to me that it's important for us to try to pin that down. One thing that's helpful is Paul talks about in Romans 5, he talks about the period of time between Adam and the law. And if I'm understanding the point that he's making there, in essence what he's saying is Adam and Eve had a specific command that they broke when they ate of the fruit of the tree. When Moses comes along and gives the law, once again, we have explicit commandments from God that a person could look at and say, okay, here's what God has required, and I could measure, am I doing or not doing what God asked. But in between that period of time, just because people didn't know, they didn't have any communication from God saying, here are the rules, they were still sinners. They were still evil people. There was still sin in the world. Because sin is not just getting a command and saying no, but it is the kind of person that I am. I mean, God didn't send the flood on the world because he gave a bunch of commandments to everybody and they didn't keep them. He just looked at people's at the way they were living. What are their hearts set on? What are they all about? It's evil. So the biblical picture is not just of sin being I get a rule and I break it, but it is that inner disposition that does come out when there is a commandment, when there's some kind of, when God makes clear to me how I ought to live. What Paul says, what the law does is it makes clear what's going on in me, what kind of person I am. When God makes it clear what life ought to look like, and then I don't look that way, now I can't just claim ignorance. I can't just say, well, I didn't know any better. I do know better, and I still don't look that way. And so now the explanation must be something deeper. So I don't know quite what to point you to, the weapon to use to when people make that sort of point to say, see, it's different than that, except to say that consistently the picture is one of the commands, the external things as being the outward indicators of what's going on inside. So when it comes to children and that kind of stuff, the fact is, I mean, I don't know how God has decided to deal with that situation, but is there a human being there? I think yes. Is there a will being expressed in that human being? Yes. Is it a will that is set on its own way? Has anybody here ever been a parent? Yes. So, I mean, there's no question but that, I mean, it's not the environment that turns babies into sinful adults. There's no question about that in my mind. I mean, they start out being willful and set on themselves, and we stay that way all the way along. I mean, that's the way we are. So I'm with you at any rate. I mean, I think it is very important to recognize that. That's why the good news is such good news, because it's not just, I mean, we would hardly even need the internal kind of stuff that you're talking about if it's just a question of here's some rules and I broke them, but now it's been explained to me more clearly, you know, what the rules are, and now I'll just, you know, do what it is. No. I mean, the problem is, as Paul says, he discovers the law brings him to the point where he looks and says, that's where I want to be, that's what I want to do, and I don't do it. And I don't want to go there, that is not the place to be, and that's exactly where I end up. now I'm really in trouble. I'm in trouble. If I can know what the good is and want to go there in some sense, and yet I can't get there, that's trouble. And now the whole idea that the Spirit of God would be at work on my life, that I would be forgiven for my sins and rescued from my sins, now that makes, this is great news, because I am really lost. I'm not just confused, I'm dead. I'm sunk. I'm cooked. I mean, you know, this is, I can't get there. And yet, God can get me there. God will get me there. And that's why the news is as good as it is.
Earlier you mentioned reconciliation, mm-hmm. that God is reconciling us. Yeah. Do you see that as a completed work, or is that part of that journey that you alluded to, or is it just completed in that we're made righteous?
Well, I think you could describe it in both ways. It depends on what you mean. Let me take another word that I think is like that. I am going to answer your question, but if we talked about a concept like salvation, and if I were to ask, is salvation a completed work? Am I saved? I think the biblical answer would be, yes, I am, and no, I'm not, depending on what you mean, depending on what the sense of it is. We could look at something where salvation is talked about as if it's a thing that has been done. And we can also look at places where it talks about salvation as something that I don't have yet. It all depends on what you mean, what the sense of it is. And I think, fundamentally, I think the answer would be the way reconciliation is talked about most of the time, it is a completed work. I mean, I am reconciled to God. Romans 5, Paul's stuff about how when we were enemies, the fact is I was the enemy of God, but now I am not, because I have been reconciled. And he very much is talking about where I am now as a believer, not where I will be someday, but in fact he's building from the idea, since I have been reconciled to God now, can't I then expect God's favor to continue and to bring me to the goal in the end? If I'm reconciled to him now, why would he ever give up on me then, you know, that sort of thing. So yeah, reconciliation is in essence something that has happened now. If we're talking about my coming under God's acceptance, I am not on a journey toward God's acceptance, I am accepted now. But I think there's another sense in which you can talk about reconciliation, kind of reconciliation applied, where not just that I have been accepted, but the fruits of that acceptance, the results of that acceptance have finally worked themselves out. And in that sense, then, reconciliation is this process, we could say, where ultimately I'm going to arrive at the place where I have everything that God intends for those with whom he is reconciled. And in that sense, it's a process. But the important thing I would want to emphasize is, if I'm thinking about what does God think of me now, where do I stand with him, I very, very much agree with Luther's assessment of that stuff, where he described justification not as coming in bits, but all in a heap, he said. It's not that I sort of slowly get more and more justified with God, but rather I am justified with God. I am right with God as a believer right now. I can't get any righter. He's not going to be happier with me someday. I have been accepted. And in that sense, I think it's a done deal.
Is there anything a believer can do to actually turn that off or reverse that? Make God back into our enemy?
No. I mean, that's a debate. I mean, you will find people who give a different answer to that. But the confusion comes in when we talk about those kinds of questions. The confusion comes in as to when we're reading the Bible, how much of it should we understand at various places to be, forgive me, some of you may not be familiar with this word, but it's the word that always comes to mind for me. How much of it is phenomenological? That is, how much of it is just describing the phenomena that we see in the world? What I see in the world is people who go along, happy little believers, and all of a sudden they come along and they tell God to get lost and they go off and never return. Okay, well, can you lose your salvation? Sure, I just saw it happen. There was a person cruising along, a believer, and then they told God to get lost and then they went off. But what is it that was going on behind the scenes? Is this a person who was justified and accepted by God and then they told God to get lost and they lost it? I would say no. That ultimately, the one who is justified before God is the one, he is the one in whom the Spirit of God is at work, the one who has been called by God, the one who hears Jesus' voice and responds, and the one who comes to him, he doesn't lose a one, and you know, all of that kind of thing. That we are working out in this life, we're seeing either the reality or the absence of reality of our own commitment to God, our own heart. That's not a very good way to say it. I'm seeing what is in my own heart as I live out my life. And so, yes, I will see people, just as Jesus describes in that parable, you know, it's like the seed that grows up quickly and then it withers. Very much we see that. But that's not losing your salvation. That's someone who expresses an interest in something that they never really grabbed a hold of, because God did not really have a hold of them. That's how I would understand it. So, no, I don't stand in God's grace and then come out from under His grace. If I am under His grace, I stay there. But the question of whether I'm under it or not is something that works itself out over time. Thank you.
It is not my wish to delve into a discussion of determinism at all. So don't think I'm trying to do that. But if God made man with the unique ability to choose, but to have the ability...
This sounds like a conversation that is going in that direction. I can see it happening.
Well, okay, all right.
That's all right, though. You can go
right,
there.
If we were standing in the grace of God, would you agree that at least to a small extent we've chosen to be there?
Not to a small extent, to a total extent.
Okay.
Yeah, I chose to be there. Yes, sir.
Right.
Yes,
cool.
Ma'am. Yes,
okay.
I did.
So if we've chosen to be there,
mm-hmm.
then if we were never able to say, I choose not to be here any longer, would that not have completely removed a part of our character the day we chose to be there? And if, in fact, it did remove a part of our character the day we chose to be there, why would God still want us? I mean, it seems to me that it takes away part of who we are if we do not have a choice to step away from His will also.
Okay. See, this is a discussion about the sovereignty of God. That's exactly where we are. See, it all depends on what you... If we picture this choice as being... There's this building, and there's a door, and we come up to the door, and we say, I think I'll go in. And I'm inside for a while, and so... you know, we're waiting for, there's a big earthquake coming and everybody who's in the building is going to be okay and everybody who's not in the building is going to be destroyed. Okay, so I freely chose to be in the building, but while I'm in there, I look around and say, yeah, I don't like it so much in this building. I think I'll go out. So I walk out the door just as I walked in it. If I picture salvation as being like that, it's... Salvation just depends on, did I open the door and go in or not? Then, sure, either I'm still a free agent who can walk out the door just as I walked in it, or else all the doors on this place only open from the outside. And when I go and try to get out, they won't let me out. I'm in here, and it so happens that the earthquake comes and I'm saved, but I didn't. I wanted out. You know, I was. If I had had my way, I would have gotten out of here. But it just so happens that he doesn't let you leave. Like, always brings to mind Hotel California. You can check out anytime you want, but you can never leave. So, if it's like that, if salvation depends on am I in the building or am I outside the building, and if I have a choice to make, which I do, I mean, you understand, I'm fully committed to the idea that ultimately God is sovereign and that my choices come under His choices. But still, they are my choices to make. So, I could believe that God is sovereign and that you can lose your salvation. I mean, I could picture reality as being such that you walk in the door, you walk out the door. It was God's sovereign choice, I mean, ultimately, but it was my choice to walk in, it was my choice to walk out, and I could walk in and out all you want. It was kind of musical chairs. I keep walking in and out, and I just hope that I'm in when the earthquake comes and the, you know, the music stops and everything's going. So, if it were like that, then sure. If he allows me to choose to go in, but not to choose to come out, then something has happened there. My choice has been taken away from me. But that's not the picture that I have. The picture that the Bible paints, I would say, is of the choice that I am making is an expression of my heart. I turn away from God because I have a heart that is set against Him. I have eyes that can't see. I can look at something and yet I can't see the reality. I have ears that can't hear. I can listen to what Jesus says and yet it just doesn't mean anything to me. Or, on the other hand, I can have a heart by the grace of God, by the Spirit of God, that can see, that can actually respond and understand the truth of what it is that God is saying there. And because I have a heart like that, I may wrestle and struggle and thrash about with things, but I'm not being saved because I happen to be in the building at the moment. I'm being saved because I have the kind of heart, I have ears to hear. I am one of those, as Jesus says, that hears His voice and responds. My sheep know my voice. Why do I know His voice? Because I'm one of His sheep. Because that's the kind of person I am. And so, in that sense then, my choice is free all the way along. That is, I am making the choices that I want to make. My choice to stay is just as free as my choice to go in at the first place was. It's always an expression of my will. It's an expression of my heart. But the thing is, my heart is the kind of heart that wants God. So I stay with Him. So the Calvinistic doctrine of the perseverance of the saints is what it's saying is, you know, I shouldn't have put it that way. I'm not a Calvinist because Calvin said things. I just happen to think that this is what the Bible is saying. But that old doctrine of the perseverance of the saints, the idea of it is I stay because I'm the sort of person who wants to stay. That's how I understand. So in the Bible, when it pictures the testing of my faith and growing in confidence and hope through the testing of my faith, what's the dynamic there? Why would it give me hope to have my faith tested? Because when I come up against those things that would, those obstacles, those things that would push me away, and yet I don't go away, in spite of the obstacles, in spite of what it costs me, I stay trusting God because I want it. That shows something about what's going on in me. And so that perseverance is encouraging because it shows that the free choices that I am making are arising from one kind of heart and not another. So anyway, it's a very complicated subject, but that would be my answer, It's not that my choice to stay is less free than my choice to get in. They are all equally my choices, reflecting who I am.
I've always heard previously when I first became a Christian that in the Old Testament it talks about how God gives you the desires of your heart. And I've been taught that, well, if I desire that, God's going to give it to me. If I desire that, God's going to give it to me. Until later, as I matured and plus heard more teaching and read more of the Word, it essentially means that God has placed those desires in my heart to want the things He wants, not so much what I want to want. And that, I believe, goes back to what you were saying about the will to choose or not to choose and having the right heart. God placed that heart in us in the first place.
Right. That is what I understand. When Moses, like I was saying earlier, when Moses says to Israel, here you face this question, are we going to love God and be blessed by following Him? He says, you know what you guys are going to do? You're not going to do it. What is the solution? What is God going to do? God is going to come along and circumcise your heart to love the Lord your God. I mean, it's pretty explicit. I mean, the choice you face is you need to love God. And you know what? You're not going to do it. And you never are going to do it, and you're going to continue not to do it. Thanks. I'm a little clumsy. And it's a tragedy because great hardship is going to come upon your people. What's the solution? God's going to change your heart. That's right, give you a heart of flesh instead of a heart of stone. That's the way Ezekiel describes it. And Jeremiah talks about writing the law on their heart and that sort of thing. Again, all of which, you're going to live ultimately because you're going to become the sort of people who do not blow God off anymore. And that's something that God is going to do for you, ultimately. And so, the new covenant, the part of it that we as believers now enter into is essentially that same thing. Paul in 2 Corinthians describes the Corinthians as they're this letter that Christ is writing in their hearts. The idea that there is something that needs to be true of me in order for me to be the sort of person who will love God and live. And the great thing ultimately is that the thing that I cannot do for myself, God is doing for me. And that's very much what I understand.
It's kind of like God injected us with a drug of Himself, and we're addicted to Him. You know, we need to have our...
Yes, although the only trouble I have with that picture is, I mean, it's very good in one sense. We can have that sense that with the addiction to a drug, that there's something that the drug has created in us, a dependence on something that is unnatural and maybe unhealthy and kind of, you know, it has taken us away from the normal course of things over to something sort of strange. The kind of addiction we get to God is actually more like an unaddiction. We have been addicted to error, and God is injecting us with that kind of drug that removes our addiction to error so that we can actually see the truth and follow it. So it's like
immunization.
Immunization. Yes. Yeah. Well, exactly. Yes. That's right. It's that sort of anti-addiction, which is the same thing. I mean, it's freedom. It is a power.
So
yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, can you speak a little bit to the pleasing of God, because as you said that He is totally pleased with us because of the work of Jesus Christ. And yet there's a place in the Bible, of course, that says whether you're in the body, whether you're absent from the Lord, or, no, I can't remember exactly how it goes, but your aim is to please the Lord daily.
Right.
So in our human condition, it seems like it's hard to hold both. We may know that we may want to know that He's totally pleased with us, but then on the other hand, we're aware that we don't please Him sometimes, or maybe we're in a difficult period when we just feel like, boy, I'm not pleasing to the Lord at all. But seems like it's hard for humans, or maybe for me, to hold both of those things in the
right.
and the hands at the same time.
Right, right. Well, I understand those to be, again, see, you ask me a question and I'm going to make a distinction. That's what I do. My job in life is to make distinctions. And so I'm going to make one. When I talk about being pleasing to God, I'm talking about that, like when Paul uses the language, if God is for us, who can be against us? And when I say that we are always pleasing to God, what I mean is God is always for us. There is no time when I have somehow that he is sending less good my way or something because of something that I have done, that I have to somehow get back in his good graces. That he is always on my side and always working for my good. The Romans 8 thing about all things work together for good, that is all things for those who are called according to his purpose. It's not just all things if you happen to be not sinning. It's all things work together for good for those people. But when Paul talks about we have as our ambition whether here at home with the Lord to be pleasing to him, now he's talking about the fact is that I know that God has a character, that God hates sin, loves goodness, that, you know, Paul uses language like walking in a manner worthy of our calling. We know that the God who has called us into life is one kind of God and not another. He loves some things, he hates other things. And now I'm asking myself, the choices I'm making, am I making them as a faithful follower of God? Would, if I were to ask him, the way I have gone, is this the kind of thing you like or the kind of thing you don't like? It is my goal to live such a life that I am always pursuing those things that God is pleased with and not the things that God is not pleased with. But not because my standing with him depends on whether he's pleased with those things.